You're listening to the North Canton Chapel podcast. Thank you for joining us today. The North Canton Chapel exists to make much of Jesus every day to everyone. It's our prayer that this podcast will equip you to do just that. We believe that there's nothing like the church united together in gospel community. We'd love if you'd stop in and say hello in person if you're in our neighborhood. Our gathering times are at 9 and 10:30 a.m. Thank you again for joining us today. Let's listen in.
Well, hey, North Canton Chapel, thank you so much for joining us online. This feels a little bit different, as we said. It's going to be a little bit different of a morning. Our message portion, our sermon this morning in live room right here is going to be on Hosea 14. This message, though, this sermon is pre-recorded about a week and a half early, and I'll explain why kind of as we move forward. I was thinking about kind of where we could go this morning. And especially for those of you that are joining us as part of our online community, we wanted to give you something very special. So we're having a ministry partner who's joining us here this morning. And because of the sensitive nature of where he serves and how he serves and the ministry he does, we're not able to do the whole message portion like we normally do for you guys. So it's a little bit different. But yeah, as I was thinking and praying it through, my heart was drawn to Psalm chapter 2. And I know we're supposed to be finishing up Hosea, and that's great. And maybe we can have a conversation about Hosea 14. I'd love to buy you a cup of coffee, and we could sit and talk together. But honestly, as we were praying this through here about a week and a half ahead of where you're watching this, I opened up my phone this morning. I was sitting in my study at home on my recliner having my cup of coffee. I opened up my phone, and like the first three news stories were all about what's happening in the Middle East. And they're connected to what's happening here in our country. Conversation is heating up again around things that are happening in the globe, things happening around the world, political things, spiritual things. How do all these things intersect? And I'll be honest with you, I'm down there at like 5:30 having a cup of coffee in my recliner, in my study at home, and I felt this wave of anxiety come up in me. And I'm going, man, first off, it's way too early and I've only had one cup of coffee. Why do I feel this anxious? And then my thought was like, gosh, I wonder if many others in our church family might feel the same way. And I'm willing to bet that you do. And so I wanted to reorient us to a place together here this morning. God took me this morning to Psalm chapter 2, and I want to go back there again. We were in Psalm 2 this last fall together as a church. We did a series called Certainty in the Psalms, but Psalms for me are just such a centering place. And I went to Psalm 2 this morning, and I sank in it, and I was like, oh my goodness, God, that was just such exactly what I needed to be reminded of. And so my hope this morning is, as much as we're watching the headlines or maybe looking at, you know, the news apps that you've got on your phone or feeling all the feelings that are just kind of in the atmosphere these days, I want Psalm 2 just to be a centering thing for us this morning. So a little bit of introduction, and then we'll get to the text. So I love the Psalms, and if you're, you know, part of North Canton Chapel, if you've heard us preach around here, you probably know that Psalms is a very dear book to me. So just four quick points of intro, and then we'll get to the text itself. First off, Psalms are so public. The Psalms are Israel's prayer book. We make the mistake of thinking that these are private things, like my prayer life is just for me alone. That's a huge mistake. Psalms are very public, where we talk about what God is doing in the world. There's a lot of like first person plural pronouns, we, us. And I think that's good for us as a church to remember that these are very, very public words. Second thing, Psalms are very present. And what I mean by that is this is not some like disconnected, idealized, romantic world that we think about. These like green pastures and still waters and all these images that come up. This isn't fantasy land. This is real. And as I looked through my news app this morning, I was confronted with real images of like violence and smoke-filled buildings and flames and angry faces and people moving people, grabbing them by the collar and moving them through busy streets. And I'm going, ugh. And what I don't need is I don't need a retreat. I need something to speak to my very present moment. And that's exactly what Psalms gives us. They're public and they're very present. Another thing, and this may rattle you, I don't know. The Psalms are very political. And I don't know if that surprises you to hear me say that. So I want to be very clear. They're very political. They're not partisan, okay? So if you're looking for partisan politics, you're probably not going to find that in the Psalms. But what you will find is very political language. Political, the root word means polis, which means has to do with like the city and the people. And that's what we get. The book of Psalms is not like looking down on us like a Sistine Chapel. It is rising up around us like newspapers. It's a very political book. It's certainly dangerous to mix politics and religion. These two things, when you put them in the same jar and shake them up, you never know what's going to happen. Nevertheless, God's word insists that we do. We cannot hit pause on our world when we come into a sanctuary like this or when we open a Bible and retreat away. We actually need this to help us shape our world. The last thing that I want to give you, and then we'll get to Psalm 2, is the Psalms are intensely practical. They're practical. A notion that I hear a lot as a pastor, nobody really says it to me directly because everyone's too nice, but I catch shades of this idea a lot that you know, prayer is a nice thing to do, but it's not really the necessary thing to do. The necessary thing to do is get out there, you know, and get to work, you know? We've got God over here and we should acknowledge him, but then we've got stuff we have to do. And to that end, I want to read you a quote from one of my favorite thinkers, Eugene Peterson, who shapes the way that I think about the book of Psalms a lot. I'm just going to read it to you. It'll show up on your screens. We don't need a new movement to save America. I mean, that right there should get your attention. We don't need a new campaign, a new conscience raising, a new program, new legislation, new politics, or a new reformation. The people who meet in worship and offer themselves and acts of prayer are doing what needs to be done. The acts of prayer are not restricted to what they do on their knees or in worship. Some are highly visible in political movements, while others work obscurely in unnoticed and unlikely places. These people have recognized the deep, embracing, reforming, revolutionizing character of prayer. It is the essential work in shaping a society and informing the soul. I love that so much because it just runs right in the face of a lot of the times how we think about prayer. That like, well, prayer is what we do before the work and prayer is what we do after the work, but the work itself, that's what's important. What we see in Psalms is no, the work is prayer. We are called to pour ourselves leaning into God, seeking him in the daily activities of our life. And so Psalm 2, this is exactly where it comes from. Psalm 2 sounds like it could have been written yesterday to me. I could have been scrolling that same news feed, and Psalm 2 could have been the next story because it's so prescient for our times. So let's get to it. Psalm 2 breaks into four parts. First, you got verses 1 through 3 that names our problem. We have a big problem. The first couple of verses name it. Then, God's response to the problem. What does God do? The third part is God's promise. And then the last thing is what our response should be. So we're kind of at the bookends of this thing, and God is right in the middle. Here's Psalm 2. Starts with a question. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of earth set themselves and their rulers take counsel together against the Lord and his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. So striking to me. This psalm begins with a question. He says, why? Why is it this way? When I look at our world, that's a question that I ask. I flip through my newsfeed and I go, why? What in the world is going on? Why is it this way? And he names it. He says, why do the nations rage? Why do the peoples plot in vain? There's 150 psalms, okay? 150 of them all strung together that form this patchwork showing us how to pray. Everything our souls can feel finds voice in the psalms. Of those 150 psalms, eight of them begin with a question. Of those eight, five begin with the same question, why? It's the toughest question you could possibly ask, is when your eyes are open and you're looking at your world and you go, why is this the way that it is? Why is what's happening happening? And it's interesting because he doesn't seem very content, the writer of this particular psalm. Why do they rage? Why do they plot in vain? Like he's looking around going, really? This? So let's take a look at those two words, rage and plot. Those are just phenomenal words because that's exactly what's happening in our world today. Rage, it's not a complicated word in Hebrew. It means exactly what you think it means. It means to behave with violent restlessness. It's the opposite of peace. It's this constant like foaming and fomenting and just like anger, restlessness, pointing outward. There's a violent restlessness in the people of the world that's led by their kings. And there's this churning phrase where he says, why? Why is it this way? And he pushes to the second question. He says, why do you plot in vain? Plotting is kind of exactly what you might imagine. It's consistent rebellion. It's murmuring. It's groaning. That's the Hebrew word there. Like the nations are like agitated waves on the sea. And he says, why? Why? And then he says, but this is in vain, which I don't think we should overlook. Vain. I think it's wise of us to see that all the raging of the world and all the plotting, all the planning, all the, you know, endless politicking, he goes, look, it's in vain. It leads absolutely nowhere. Nothing actually substantive happens. And then he goes, why is that? Why does this happen? Now, here's where most of us, I think, are probably ready to supply him with an answer. Like, well, I know why this happens. If you want to know why the nations rage and the people's plot, let me tell you why. The partisan among us would say, well, because this person's in power or that person's not in power or, you know, I don't think that's it. The theologically toned among us might say, well, sin is the reason why. Well, yes, but it's more complicated than that. The nostalgic among us might go, I know why the nations rage and the people's plots, because they took the Ten Commandments down from the courthouse. That's why. Well, yeah, but no, there's more than that. The mystic among us might quote Marvin Gaye, who go, mercy, mercy me, things are not what they used to be, right? And all of those things are kind of right, but they're symptoms of the problem. They're not the real problem itself. Here's what he says in verse 2. He says, the kings of earth set themselves and their rulers take counsel together. Against who? Against each other? No. Against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. What's he saying? This is amazing and deeply ironic, but really sobering. He says, however antagonistic you think worldly powers are from each other, they're actually united together against God. That's a striking statement. If you're just looking kind of on the outside, it looks like they're all against each other. He's offering us a very different perspective, saying, no, they take counsel together against God, saying, let's be done with God. What are they seeking? Rebellion from God. They want to be against God, self-lordship, self-authority, a reality where God is pushed to the periphery in favor of self-rule. Now, let me get like as close to partisan as I'm going to get this morning. Whether you're on this side or this side, autonomy is bad. If you're on this side of the political spectrum and you go, gosh, this is a person who is so self-convinced and like this is, you still need God. If you go over here and you go, well, we don't want any kings, we want nothing. Well, that's also equally bad. This is wrong and this is wrong, equally wrong. Because they're autonomous, they're without God. Godlessness is destruction. And this is what Psalm 2 offers us right at the beginning, is God's rule actually brings freedom. It's man's rule from whatever side that brings slavery. And that's the crux of the problem. We are raging for different forms of slavery. While God is sitting here going, look, I'm offering you something better. Just a side note, and then we'll continue. I think we have to be very careful about what we accept as normal. Raging and plotting, this is not how we are supposed to do this. This is not how things are supposed to be. The nations are not supposed to rage, and the people are not supposed to plot. They're supposed to be doing something different, which we won't see until verse 10. So what's God's perspective on this whole thing? This raging and plotting. And now the camera pans upward. It shifts from earth to the halls of heaven. Verse 4, he who sits in heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fearing, saying, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. This is God's response to man's raging. And to pick up the power of what we see here, I want to follow the tense of the verbs. Okay, so for you grammar people, you know who you are. You're already with me. There are five verbs here, but together they paint a really compelling portrait. The first two verbs come as a present tense pair in verse 4. He who sits in heaven laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Man rages and God laughs. We've got to see this for what this is. This is not a harmless laugh. This isn't just like frivolous. This is a laugh that borders on anger. It's developed by the second verb where he says he holds them in derision, which means when you watch what's happening in the would-be powers of our world, it's comically tragic because it offends the glory of God. The second pair of verbs catapult us into the far future. At the right time, God will finally have the floor, and then here comes the couplet in verse 5. He will speak to them in the day of his wrath, and he will terrify them in his fury. This is God going, there is a day coming where everyone who thinks that they're a leader is going to have to bow the knee. I will speak. Right now, I'm silent. I will speak. And when I speak, it will be terrifying. This is foreshadowing a future day of judgment yet to be seen, when God will bring a reckoning to anyone who's pushed him off. Well, what's he going to say? We get that in verse 6. He says this, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. Here's what I want us to notice. This verb is past tense. It's already happened. This is God saying, look, what I have done through my king, the king that I have appointed, it's already done. He's already been installed. He's already been set on Zion, my holy hill. This king will not be removed. He cannot be questioned. It's as good as done. I have already set him. Now, fascinating and tantalizing little detail that foreshadows who this king actually is. That verb, I have set, or your translation might say, I have installed. That verb is elsewhere translated, I have poured out my king on Zion, my holy hill. And it's also sometimes used in connection with a drink offering. And so part of this king's installation service or setting could be looked at as a sacrifice. I'll just leave that there for you. But let's get back for a second. Let's kind of take a couple steps backward, and we've really got to get a fresh imagination for what the psalmist is talking about here. From time to time, you guys know that I like to read the Message. The Message is not a translation. It's an interpretation of Scripture, and it's a really good one because a lot of times it takes these words in Scripture that are sometimes hard to understand, and it puts them in modern language or language that, you know, is a little bit more natural for us. Here's how the Message puts these first two parts of Psalm 2. Just listen to this. He says, why the big noise, nations? Why the mean plots, people? Earth leaders push for position. Demagogues and delegates meet for summit talks. The God deniers, the Messiah defiers. Let's get free of God. Let's cast loose from Messiah. Heaven-throned God breaks out laughing. At first, he's amused at their presumption, and then he gets good and angry. Furiously, he shuts them up. Don't you know there's a king in Zion? A coronation banquet is spread for him on the holy summit. I love that. Like, that's just so refreshing to me, because what he's really saying is like, what is all the fuss about? What is the big deal? Why are you wringing your hands? Why are you losing so much sleep? Don't you get it? Don't you understand what's really happening? How do you miss what's really going on? How are you so unaware of what God has done? There is a king, and he's on a throne, and his rule can't be questioned. What's your relationship to him? That's really the question that he's pushing these leaders, these world rulers, these very influential type of people to think about. You're going to have to give an account for your leadership before this king. What's going to happen on that day? There's a very powerful principle for us in here that I want us to see, and it's just this. God intends that the anxiety of our present fears which I feel and you probably feel too. God intends that the anxiety of our present fears be stilled by the certainty of his past accomplishments. I'll say that again. God intends that the anxieties of our present fears be stilled by the certainties of his past accomplishments. When I look at what God has done, that needs to impact how I live my life here. That matters. The installation, the setting of a king being poured out like a drink offering on God's holy hill, that has to impact my present. There is a king. He was placed there by God. He is the answer to the raging of the world. So who is this king? Three things we should look out for. This shows up in verse 7. Now the king himself speaks. Here's what he says. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me and I'll make the nations your heritage, the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. So much here that I want to talk about. So much that we could fill the next like hour and a half with. But a couple of things. First off, we need to see that this king will come from David's line. There's a sonship here. This earth-silencing king will be part of David's family tree. Way back in 2 Samuel 7, I want to read this to you. There was a promise that God made to David. Theologians call it the Davidic covenant. It's just the David promise. And here's what it says. This is 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 12. God promises this to David. He says, when your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, meaning when you die, I will raise up your offspring after you. He'll come from your own body. I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name. I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever, and I will be to him a father, and he will be to me a son. This is God telling David that there's another king coming after David dies, one of David's descendants, that will be like a son to God. You hear what he's hinting at, right? This king will have God's favor. God will not remove his favor from this king. Psalm 2, this is God re-upping this promise, reminding us that there's something about this king's relationship that's very different. Second thing you got to look out for this king is he will have a global influence. I love this. It says, I'll make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You think about our world today, right? There's hardly anything unifying about our world. And I know that sounds negative, but we have like different languages, different cultures, different policies, different lines that are drawn in like our post-Tower of Babel experience. It's always conflict. There's always rebellion. But one day, all of the nations, all of the peoples of earth will be brought under the good rule of this good king into a time of peace and prosperity. Boundaries will fade. Armies will fail. Initiatives will fall by the wayside. This is an echo of what God said to Abraham way back in Genesis 22. God promised this, Genesis 22, verse 17. He says, I will surely bless you. I'll surely multiply your offspring. There's that word again. As the stars of heaven, the sand that's on the seashore, and your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies, and your offspring, or and in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. There's something about this king in Psalm 2 that's going to spill the banks of national boundaries. He'll have a global influence. Third thing we should look for shows up in verse 9 of Psalm 2, that this king is going to rule in might with unquestioned authority. He says, you will break them with a rod of iron. You'll dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. So as this picture of this king becomes a little bit sharper in its focus, we start to connect the dots. Psalm 2 is this subversive, sly reminder that although earthly leaders think that they're influential, even though they think that they're making a difference, even though they're plotting and raging, even though they're spending their influence trying to get you to believe in them, one day their knees will bow before this king. Now you put all that together, and we'd be very practical. Here's what that means. No matter who is on whatever throne in this world, Jesus is king. No matter whose name is in the headlines, Jesus is king. No matter who sits at the White House, Jesus is king. No matter who launches what on who, Jesus is king. But here's the trouble with that idea. A lot of times Christians say that, and it's actually really harmful. Because we go, well, yeah, but what do I do with the life that I have? Like, I just go, Jesus is king, and then, like, blissfully, kind of, like, mindlessly move around in the world? Like, that's, what do I do with that? Like, it sounds nice and preachy and good and memorable and idealistic and quaint and naive, and but it doesn't really matter, right? Because, like, heaven's going to be great. Yeah, I'm there. Bible, yeah, whatever. But I've got work to do, and that's a great sentiment for Sunday morning, but it doesn't help me here. That's the problem, because in Psalm 2, what we see is God pushing a reality out there into us, saying, not only do I have a king, his kingship matters. Let me just speak to you as a pastor for a moment. That's the thing, one of the things that troubles me the most, is that we have a disconnect between the kingship of Jesus, which we accept in theory, but deny in practice, because there's a disconnect between his kingship in, you know, this room on Sunday morning and then my car on Monday morning or my office on Monday afternoon. If Jesus' kingship is real, Jesus' kingship matters. The intersection of politics and religion does not lead to some escapist, disconnected quietude. We're not given Psalm 2 as a plaque to hang on the wall, but as a prayer for our souls. This is not a retreat for private contemplation, but a reminder for public proclamation. God's word instructs us to boldly pray, whether we say these words out loud or with the lives that we live, hopefully both, because one truth matters. Christ is king. He is now ruling with authority, and one day every knee is going to bow. He has an unquestioned right to rule. And if that doesn't impact the way we think about the paltry movements of our world that at the time seem so compelling and so captivating and so consequential, but in reality are as seismic and as substantial as diminutive drops of water in a giant bucket, they just don't matter with what's really going on, with what God has really done. If that doesn't shake you, Psalm 2, then I worry for you. Here's another way to think about Psalm 2. Psalm 2 is a prayer, yes, but it doesn't read like a prayer. It reads like an open letter to world leaders. And I imagine, like, God kicks open the door of a closed-door cabinet meeting. You know the kind of things you see on the news sometimes where there's, like, a big table with, like, ivory tablecloths, and there's like pitchers of water, and there's world leaders sitting around with microphones and translators and like notes, and you know, they're all trying to be very diplomatic. And then just God kicks open the door, and because he doesn't need an invitation, and he goes, boom, and he unloads verses 1-9, and everybody shuts up because they don't know what to do. God has the floor, and he gives them the first 9 verses of Psalm 2, and then he gives them these last couple of verses as the camera shifts back from the blindingly brilliant upward of heaven. Now it comes back to earth. What are we supposed to do with this? What's our response? Here's verse 10, 5 imperative verbs. He goes, therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear. Rejoice with trembling. And then the one that's the weirdest of all, he says, kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way. Why? For his wrath is quickly kindled. And then this last word of blessing. Blessed are all those who take refuge in him. 5 imperative verbs. I want you to hear these. The first one is be wise. Another way of understanding that is assess your situation. Reckon with God's reality. He says, be warned. Be warned. Jesus is not just some quiet, kind, limp. Be warned. He's a king with whom you must reckon. See this as the shot across the bow. You may not get another one. Serve the Lord with fear, which means take an inventory of how you're leading, of the posture in which you hold the positions that you do, and align that with the heart of God. Serve the Lord. Let every ounce of influence you have be under his authority. Fourth, rejoice with trembling. There's a humility to leadership. I feel that just as a pastor and like as a dad and as a husband. Like if leadership swells your pride and ego, you're not doing it right. And then the last one, which to me, this verb is the trickiest of all, but it's probably the most beautiful. Kiss the son. In the ancient world, to kiss the feet of a king was a sign of allegiance and humility. And so the poem closes with that great one-line benediction. He says, "Blessed are all who take refuge in him." And that's the sticking point. That's the target of this whole psalm. If you want certainty and you want the anxieties of your heart to be still, then you want to be able to make sense of what this world is doing and what's going on. You want hope. You want to be saved. You want deliverance. You want to have a kind word to say. You want to have a meaningful comment to add to the conversation. Here's what it is. Take refuge in him. Take refuge in this king. And so we got just a couple minutes. And I know this Sunday's a little bit different for you, part of our online community. It's not the normal worship service, and that's okay. But in the last couple of minutes we've got, I just have two questions that I need to ask you. And then I'll pronounce a benediction on us, and you can get on with your afternoon. Probably the first question is, who or what are you counting on for salvation? What is going to save you from the threats that you have? And here's the thing, all of us, whether we would confess it or not, have actions that testify to what we actually believe. Example, well, what if I get all the information? I gotta consume all the news stories. I have to be so on top of it. Okay, is that what's gonna really save you from the threat? No. What about like anger? I'm going to get good and angry, and that's going to be the thing that saves me and makes sense of my world, because what's really wrong with the world is people don't know my opinion. That's not going to save you. Let me be very clear. The biggest threat that we have is eternity without God. And the only way that you get eternity with God is Christ. Nothing in this world can save you. Nothing that you could possibly trust in, if it's not Christ, can restore what's really broken in you and in our world. And so let me plead with you, if you're still looking for something else to save you, whether it's your own efforts or it's something this world is dangling in front of you, give it up and trust Christ. Kiss the Son. Second question that I probably need to ask you is just as important. It sounds like it's the same question, but it's a little bit different. Is not what are you counting on for salvation, but what are you counting on for hope, like actual hope to get you through the day? And I say that's just as important because Psalm 2, the kingship of Jesus is not just theory, it actually has to matter to me. And so I need to ask you, and maybe this is for those of you who are watching and you're Christians, or you'd say you're a Christian, are you actually cultivating hope in the Lord? Are you actually taking refuge in him? Or are we constructing other shelters to take refuge in? I need to tell you, trusting God for heaven, but not for your life, that's not okay. I think many Christians are going, yeah, I accept Jesus, I get it. He died for me, yada, 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 I'm there. But for the years of life that I have here, this is up to me. That's not the kingship of Christ. There's a big difference between Jesus being your Savior and him being Lord of your life. And the King who is figured here in Psalm 2 wants to be both. And so I need to ask you, what are you counting on for salvation? And what are you counting on for actual hope? Where are you putting your hope, your practical, actual hope? Because the King that's alluded to in Psalm 2, we know who it is. It's Christ. He says these things all the time in the New Testament, does he? He says, come, all of you who are weary and heavy laden. Another way of saying that is like, are you burned out? Are you overcome by the weight of the world? Does this seem like it's too much for you to bear? He says, come, come to me. I'll give you rest. I'll carry that burden for you. Such a fresh word for our times, isn't it? Christ and Christ alone, not just for salvation into the next world, but for salvation and hope in this world. So thanks for joining us today. I know it's been different, and I'm just glad that you're here. And so before we sign off and wish you a good Sunday afternoon, I want to give you these words. These are from number 6. They're how we close almost every service here at NCC. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Thanks for being here today. Go in peace.